Kathy Noble is going to get us started with just a brief word of prayer.
Let us pray. Gracious God, we come to you this afternoon filled with many, many ideas, new learnings, relearned learnings, thoughts of how we will take this home, how we will continue to tell your story and the story of your people throughout the world. As we come to this point in the day, we ask for your spirit, your energy to fill us, as again, more ideas are to come our way, and as we engage in conversation as to how we can implement those. We thank you for your presence with us, and we give you great honor and praise that that is always with us. This we do in the name of your Son and our Savior, Jesus Christ. Amen.
All right, thank you, Kathy. Well, welcome again to Shop Talk with UMCOM, a.k.a. the editors' meeting. This is that time during the year when we get together just for some open sharing of ideas, updates, and finding ways that that we can work together more effectively. I'm Tim Tanton. I'm on the staff at United Methodist Communications, and I would like to ask my colleagues from UMCOM who are here just to stand up for a quick minute. Okay. Thank you. Thank you. And we also have at least one of our commissioners here, and I would like to ask our Communication Commission commissioners to stand up as well, please. Thank you. We have a number of former commissioners in here, and this is, you know, one of the things we're going to talk about this afternoon is collaboration, and I think Commission on Communication is just one example of how we are, you know, we really do collaborate in very meaningful ways across the communications ministries of the church, and the annual conference communicators provide some of the strongest commission leadership for us. Today we are talking about the Ministry of Communications, and as part of that, and again, part of talking about collaboration, I just want to really recognize what an incredible year we have all had together, highlighted, of course, by General Conference. What an interesting experience that was, right? We at United Methodist Communications, we really value the relationships that we share. You know, when you think about it a certain way, we're really all part of one tribe of communicators, and we're very sensitive to the needs that are felt out in the annual conferences. One of the things that I want to just I want to actually share two things with you real quickly. As the new quadrennium gets going, we're going to resume our regular webinars, our conference calls, where, you know, all of us get together virtually and share challenges and focus on some specific topics and areas of communication ministry. And you will find on your tables comment cards. And so I would invite you and really urge you to take a few minutes to fill those out and to pass them on to Kathy Noble either at the end of this session or tomorrow while you're all still here at UMAC. And we will use those as we plan out the webinars for the coming year. The other thing I want to share with you is that we've been working on some ways that we can share and plan content more effectively, and we are moving toward a place where we can do content planning as general agency communicators, annual conference communicators, and other United Methodist storytellers. Do content planning in a more coordinated way, a way that has some more foresight to it. And I want to invite the UMNS editor, Maggie Hillary, up here for just a quick minute to fill you in a little bit on that.
Thank you. quick ground rules here. I'm not going to take any questions. I'll be around here the rest of the day and all day tomorrow. So if you have questions, find me. We want to move on with the rest of this program. We have been searching for some space, virtual space, where we could share with you a list of what we're doing, where we could get feedback from you, where you could share with us things you're doing, where we could talk, complain, and yet not be seen. And so we've searched to find that. And we have found that virtual space that right at the moment I can control who's in there and who isn't. And so this evening, all of you will be receiving from me, and if you don't, find me and let me know, an email that'll tell you exactly how to get into that space. When you get in there, you will find our best effort at telling you what we are doing for October, November, and December. And I also have a list of all of the videos, the major videos that UMTV has finished. They're not slotted in by date, and you will find that these documents are works in progress. We have dates on some, and some of those dates will be firm, and others may have to shift. As you well know, you can't control what's going to happen, and sometimes you have to make those changes. But we would like your participation in continuing to make those documents work for all of us. There are points in there where you will see that we need something from you. We're asking for some help from you on things. We want to hear from you. Several of you in the last week have just dropped on us some wonderful pieces that we didn't know were coming, and we are greatly appreciative of that. But we feel that it's our role to try to pull all of this together and be a clearinghouse across the connection so you can know what everyone else is doing. And we can help you to tell your stories, and you can help us to tell those other stories so that everybody shares the same information. This is a first step, and it's only a first step. And we have plenty of ways to modify it. We're open to suggestions. Tim and I have hassled for 3 weeks. He wants an Excel document. I have trouble working with the Excel documents with other folks. So there's a Word doc in there because I'm the person who put it in there. But anyway, when you get to it, we can change it to an Excel document. We can do whatever we need to do. We can go to a virtual space. This is a collaborative process. Where our heart and soul is on the content that's in there. And that's what we want to talk to you about right now, and that's what we want to hear from you on. So let me hear from you. If you didn't get it, let me hear from you once you open it and see what it is, and I'll be around for the next day and a half, and we'll work out the bugs. And I look forward to seeing you all online.
Thank you, Maggie. Okay, now on to our main event. Most of you know the Reverend Larry Holland, and if you haven't had a chance to meet him yet, I would encourage you to take the opportunity at the end of this session. Larry's career has unfolded across a timeline that is really highlighted by the dramatic change that we've seen in communications over the last several decades. He has worked in radio, in television and video, in print, and in the electronic media. Not to really make you sound dated, Larry, but he really has a very much an all-encompassing range of experience around modern communications. He also has a theological background that is shaped somewhat by his experience as a pastor of local congregations. Today, as the General Secretary of United Methodist Communications, he is really the leading voice in the church for the power of communications and also for the role of communicators. Many of you will recall that 3 years ago, Larry spoke in this session about communications as a ministry. And I think that was kind of an eye-opening moment for some of us. It was certainly a message that we all needed to hear. And not only that, but it was a message that the entire church needed to hear. And now it can do that because Larry has just published a book, We Must Speak, Rethinking Faith, Rethinking How We Communicate Faith in the 21st Century. You all will be getting a complimentary copy of this, but just to follow up on something that Mike mentioned, you will also have the opportunity to buy additional copies of it if you like. But we've included coupons at all the tables, and after our discussion this afternoon, I would invite you to come on up here with a coupon and get a book, and Larry will be available for signing the book if you wish. So what we're going to do is Larry is going to share with us about communications as ministry and his vision for where we're going and where we can go in this new century with our ministry. After that, we will have a panel of communicators up here who will lead a dialogue or a discussion time on the theme of the book, and we will have some time for some questions and discussion. So please join me in welcoming Reverend Larry Holland.
Thank you, Tim. Good afternoon. I want to assure you that what Mike McCurry said about us hearing from him weekly is an accurate statement. In fact, I want to assure you that I've said to him, yes, Mike, we got that message. But he still thinks we need to hear that message. And so would you all start putting some news about imaginal malaria in your publication so you can get Mike off my back? At least Baltimore, Washington. Melissa? It's really a joy to be here with you. This feels like being among friends and family. I am hopeful that as we work on this new space that Maggie is talking about, and as we begin to see the value of collaboration, that we can start to accomplish some of the challenge that Mike laid out for us, which is to begin to give the global United Methodist Church a sense of its wholeness and a sense of its capacity to contribute to substantial change and a sense of its ability to bring the gospel to more people in more ways than it has ever had the capacity to do before. I'm a motorcycle rider, as some of you may know, and I was loading a motorcycle onto a trailer in the parking lot of our BMW dealer a few weeks ago. And he was the owner of the dealership was helping me, and we were talking about, you know, just virtually nothing, just small talk. And I looked over to the side, and I saw parked in his lot a military personnel carrier. And it was similar to these amphibious vehicles that you see in tourist areas that carry tourists around. They're called ducks. Only this was about half the size or less than one of those ducks. And I said to him, what is that? He said, well, it's a military personnel carrier from Switzerland. This is in Nashville. I said, what are you doing with that? He said, well, I drive the kids around the neighborhood in it. And I looked at him and I said, I think you're as crazy as I am. Why do you have that? He said, well, we're here for such a short time. You got to make the most of it and enjoy every minute of it. And we went back to loading the motorcycle. What struck me was that was a life statement. That was a statement of faith about how he approaches life and what's important to him and his sort of overall philosophy. What also struck me as I've reflected on it was therein lies the challenge about how we must speak of faith in the 21st century. we have to find a vocabulary that speaks to people who have virtually no knowledge of faith and who are seeking meaning and purpose, who may be happy with life and may not be happy with life, may be broken by life and may not be broken but are celebrating life, and who lack a larger sense of community and direction that could give them even greater fulfillment and even more hope and an even more attractive and effective way to live life than to drive kids around the neighborhood in a military personnel carrier. You hear what I'm saying? It's the challenge that we have today of bringing the gospel, the good news of our relationship to God through Jesus Christ, to people who may very well be searching for that kind of an understanding of life, but don't have the language, don't have the words, and don't have the perception of what that can mean. One of the things that I was concerned about when I wrote this book, We Must Speak, is that we as mainline denominations, and in particular, we as the United Methodist Church in the mainline tradition, have essentially lost our voice in the public conversation. And as a result of losing our voice, much of the value and ethical and moral perspective that our Wesleyan heritage brings to life is left out of the discussion. And what Mike was saying earlier about the lack of a religious perspective among those who have a progressive religious faith is lost. And as a result, we get into a conversation that does not reveal the fullness of God's creation, does not reveal the fullness of the meaningful life that we can share in this creation, and most importantly, does not serve the common good. We are in a conversation in the United States, less so in other parts of the world, in which religion is a way to divide and a way that we hunker down and get behind our barricades and lob grenades at each other rather than a conversation that builds community and builds a sense of the common good and that speaks for those who might otherwise not have a voice and not be able to articulate who they are, what their needs are, and why they should be heard. Tim is right in saying that my career has spanned a wide range of the media landscape in which we operate today, you and I, as communicators. I actually started when we were working in film strips and in film slides, and we thought that three-screen presentations with old Kodak carousel projectors was the newest innovation that could come along. Yeah, the dropping of the ka-thunk slides into those projectors. And then I worked in broadcast news, broadcast radio and television, first as an ecumenical religious broadcaster, and then as a radio talk show host with no religious content at all, just doing a talk show, and moved from that to producing film, 16-millimeter film, working out of New York with Church World Service and doing film around the world, and then into video. All of that experience has not only covered those technologies, but each of those technologies has meant something different to the life of the church. each has meant that the technology shaped how the church could communicate and project its voice into the wider culture. The broadcast era was the highlight of the church's ability to communicate in the United States to a broad audience. There were reasons for that. The first was that the government required broadcasters to serve the public good, and their broadcast licenses were determined by the records they kept and by the programming that they did that demonstrated their ability to serve the public good. They also were required to provide public service time to religious organizations or other community organizations who might not otherwise have a presence in the media and who were not buying time but were serving the public good. Well, the church got comfortable with that through the radio era and through the television era, and figured when that began to change and to decline that we've had all of this influence and we've had all of this capacity to do these programs. We're not going to buy time, and we're not going to continue to produce in the way that we have because the government began to change the licensing requirements and the church got less and less time. But it will be okay because we've established ourselves and we've had this experience. What we did not understand is when it comes to public perception, no one gives you a deed that you can refer back to. As soon as you're out of it, you're out of it. And the church intentionally moved away from broadcasting as it began to experience these changes in public policy. And since that time, we have never achieved the level of public penetration of the projection of our values, of our voice, as we had during those days. Now today, it's sort of insignificant. That issue is sort of insignificant because there are so many different media that we can communicate in that our problem is not getting into the media. Our problem is being heard because the noise is so much greater now than when in broadcast there were three television networks that served in the entire continent. What I have been proposing to our leaders in the church is that we must relearn how to speak in this new environment, and that means using all the forms of media that are available to us, but it means more. It means learning to communicate with those folks like the dealer that I was talking to when we were loading the motorcycle through those media about the importance of faith and why we as a church are concerned about them and why we as a church are concerned about an inclusive and a global understanding of the world and of the common good. If we don't do that, my concern is that the only religious voices that will be heard are the voices that are most often being heard right now. And those are voices that, in my opinion, are divisive. They do not reflect the full understanding of the gospel that I believe the mainline tradition reflects. And they are voices that advocate for a particular understanding of faith and the defense of that particular understanding. And as a result, we have public debates by two presidential candidates where no one mentions the poor or the homeless. No one mentions the children who have special needs and need medical care. No one mentions mothers, single parents with children, and the financial burdens that they live in and the reality of their poverty. We are concerned as a church about those people and about those policies and about those issues that have to do with what we believe is the fullness of life. Now, let me let me close by simply saying that this is not about politics. This is about a biblical understanding that we have as mainline Christians, that we live in God's wonderful world. We are created by a God who wants to be in relationship with us and wants us to be in relationship with each other, and fundamentally calls us to heal the brokenness in the world and says to us, I want you to flourish. That is what my creation is about, for you to flourish as the heirs of my creation. We as a church must find our voice and find the vocabulary, as Mike said, to say that to people in this world that is broken and divisive and oppressive and hurting. And if we don't say it, we will not have lived up to our responsibilities to be communicators in the 21st century. And so what I tried to do in the book, and you will see this, is to lay this out in more concrete ways than I'm doing here today, and to call upon our leaders to give consideration to the challenge that we have to speak strategically in the world today. And all I mean by strategic is simply that we begin by listening to where people are and what their concerns are. We find ways to send messages to them in conversations, not in one-way messaging, that responds to those needs, that invites them into an inclusive community, that meets them where they are, in the media where they are comfortable. We live in a horizontal media environment. You and I are sending tweets, and we're using iPads and taking pictures, and some of you are online right now. We live in a media environment that is different than the human race has experienced at any other time in all of history. And so we need to learn where people are in that environment, how we can speak to them in that environment, what we can say to them, and what we offer to them in an inviting and attractional way. That's why we must speak. We also do need to address the issue of how we help our Episcopal leaders to speak. We at UMCOM offer spokesperson training and crisis management. Sometimes that's how it happens. They get into a crisis and then they are willing to do spokesperson training because they realize that the inevitable time has come when they have to deal publicly with a situation that they would otherwise have not had to deal with. And so we're trying to help to lead in that way. But the other thing, and then I'm going to stop, Tim, and we can have some questions, is that you and I as communicators have to be, I think, more intentional in helping our leaders understand that this horizontal communications environment that we are in demands of them and us to think theologically. It demands that we think about how we present faith. And it demands that we understand where God is at work in that environment and how we respond to God being at work in that environment, and find the language as well as the technology, whether it's a tweet with 140 characters or a Facebook photo or a Pinterest page or whatever it might be, a YouTube video, that can speak of faith to people whom we may never be able to communicate with face-to-face, but to whom we can extend an invitation to become a part of a face-to-face community and reach out to them through those media. That's a theological task that I think we have to accept and begin to think about. And then the very last thing I'll say is that we need to understand ourselves as people who communicate faith and not as the support group for the program planners. We do more than turn on the projector and run the PowerPoint. And we do that through the work that we do to help them understand this theology of communications and this horizontal communications landscape that we are in. We do that by the way we write the stories or develop the content or produce the videos or do any of the other work that you all are called on to do and establish ourselves as faith communicators and not as technical support folks. And if we do that, I think we have given the church a great gift. And I think we've also enabled the church, we will enable the church to find its voice and to speak in a more relevant and meaningful way. And so that's what the book is about. I share with you some of my own personal experiences and how I came into this ministry. And I'm a child of the United Methodist Church. Grew up in a family of alcoholism and domestic abuse. The place that was safest for me, my dad was an oil field worker. We were poor as church mice, and we moved every 6 months until I was 13 years of age. I can name off the little towns in South Oklahoma and West Texas and Wyoming, where we went following the rig. Every time the rig was relocated, the oil drilling unit was relocated, we went with it. And the safest place for me was the United Methodist Church. It was the place that was safe from a damaging family relationship. It was the place that was safe for someone who was new to town and didn't have any friends and didn't know how to make those friends until I got old enough, and after having had enough experience, I figured out how to do it. I want the United Methodist Church to be that relevant to every child, that it is the safe place. More than that, it's the formative place where a child understands his or her own value, his or her own worth, and begins to see a future and a hope and a possibility that they might not otherwise see, and flourish as God intends. So that's why I wrote the book. Okay, thank you.
Can we have both wireless mics up here? If somebody would run that up for us, that'd be great. My name is Greg Nelson. I'm a director of communications for the Oregon-Idaho Annual Conference. And because you all have not got your books yet, unless, of course, you pre-ordered it or got it. There were so few advances floating around, I think. Anyway, we pulled together a few communicators and got copies of the book to them so that they could read it ahead of time, and we could begin the conversation that I think you hope this book begins. So we'd like to get that conversation started today with some chat, and we've invited them to give it a careful read and think about what resonated with them, or maybe what's missing, or maybe what they disagree with. That might be interesting too. So joining us up front are Victoria Rebeck from the Minnesota Annual Conference, and Skylar Nimmons from Western North Carolina, and Laura Allen from West Virginia Annual Conference. So they kind of get the first pitch at this, and then throughout the time, you with us for the whole meeting, Larry, or do you have to scoot off to save the world somewhere? Heading to Germany this afternoon? Oh, okay. So there'll be some more time as you stay up tonight to read your book and maybe talk with Larry about it in the morning too. But so that's the plan for our thing, and each participant will have 2 minutes in each side, and then there'll be a counterpoint. And my job is to crack the whip and keep it moving along if I can. Okay.
Can we stand up? And
okay.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Okay.
Okay.
Come on.
Come on.
So my favorite Facebook picture out of it was the, you pull my finger. No, I'll pull your finger. Did someone in this room post that one? Yeah. I see the finger back there. So wondering where to start. Victoria, why don't you start? And in our totally unrehearsed way, we'll see what question you have. Go for it.
So Larry, I really appreciated your final comments about what does it mean, what does the communications ministry mean? And for so many of us, I think when I heard the yays out there, they know how I feel that communication has become, at least for conference communications, a support ministry or a program ministry when there's training involved. But in your book, you really do describe communications as a ministry, as a much more comprehensive ministry. So I'm reading this book and I'm thinking, oh boy, this is just blowing my mind. It's so different from the way I've been thinking of it. It makes sense. But how do I explain this to my extended cabinet when I go to them and say, you know what, we really need to think about our ministry of communication in a different way? So what are, say, like the three things or so, pulling a number out of the air, that I need to get across to help them to see this vision?
Yeah, I think... okay, there we are. I think one of the things that I would do is when they ask us things like, can you help us develop a PR campaign because we want to push out this message, is say, sure, I'd be glad to do that. But who is your audience? And what do you want them to do once they've heard your message? And what is in it for them? What is the message? So that you don't go in advocating for yourself, in an overt way, but you begin to raise the questions that they have not raised and don't know to raise. And part of this is that they don't know what questions to raise. When Mike speaks of our Episcopal leaders and their need to be more outspoken in the public media, the reality, as I've observed over now almost 13 years in this job, is that we don't elect people to be public leaders. We elect them to be good pastors at the Episcopal level, and they have never had, many of them have never had that training, are very uncomfortable with it. Some are even more introverted than I am, and don't feel comfortable, you know, projecting themselves, and haven't done the theology. And so what we do, Victoria, is to ask those kinds of questions. I think the other thing that we do is to build allies and partners, as we have with someone of the substance of Mike McCurry, who can be an advocate for communications in a way that you and I can't be because it seems self-serving. And it isn't self-serving. It's really about helping the church to be better at communicating, but we run that risk of sounding as if we're self-serving. So I would build partnerships on a commission on communication at a conference level that would be a strong advocate. And I think then the third thing that I would do is to work to demonstrate how we live in a different world. And when the bishop wants to do a blog or is working on how to we communicate through social media, interpret to the cabinet that this is a strategic communication function. It's not so simple as you asking me to put your blog together or to design your website. There's a real strategic value in this. And so let's talk about that before we talk about what color we're going to put on the header. Okay? Does that make sense?
The coaching modes is such a key to me. I know there's times that someone comes to me, and I spent a year telling my extended cabinet or asking the question, who's their audience, when they said they wanted to do something. And then I was shocked when a district superintendent in a meeting said, well, we have to think about the audience. And I started to go, wait a minute, that's my question. I went, no, it's good that you're doing that. You know, so the coaching piece is one that's been successful for me. Flip page. So why don't we, Skylar, I think you were talking about focus when we had a little chat earlier. Maybe you can see where that takes us.
So as I read the book, and as I often think about, you know, my job and our jobs as communicators and our job as the church, I find ourselves, you know, not really being focused on real things. Like sometimes we focus on a lot of things that are internal, but how do we get back to encouraging our leaders, our clergy, and our Episcopal leaders to really talk about things that matter to the people that we want to reach, of hunger and poverty and human sexuality, and just the immigration and the other gamut of issues that are hot button topics. But it seems that there's this worry all the time of, oh, we're going to lose members, or we're going to get letters, or we're going to get phone calls from people who are in our pews, but maybe that's what we need to do. So, but how do we encourage them to do those things?
You know, Skylar, that's an issue that Tim and I were talking about as recently as yesterday at 10 o'clock. And so I really appreciate that question. Let me say that the way that we are trying to do it at UMCOM is to move toward interpreting virtually everything we do based on research. Now, how that works in an annual conference where you may not have the same research capacity that we do at UMCOM is a question that I think I'd like for us to talk about it in some webinar sometime, or you know, kind of get our minds together about how we do that. But I think the description that Skylar has given us is exactly where we are as a church. And that is, we are very concerned about the survival of the institution and about the survival of congregations and revitalizing congregations. And what happens when we let that go in a particular direction is that we become very self-concerned. And we become less concerned about how we get engaged in mission externally with people who have real needs and with whom we ought to be in ministry. So what we have done at UMCOM is to work on research that tells us, here's what we know about the particular group or ministry or expression initiative that you're raising questions about. And here's what we know about vital congregations. And here's the best information that we have about how people get active in the world outside. Now, you all know about Rethink Church. The Change the World events, there are three or four different names of how we carry out Rethink Church. But that's exactly, Skylar, the attempt to get people focused externally rather than internally. Our experience with imaginal malaria, by the way, is that imaginal malaria converges four focus areas. It converges an outreach to youth and young adults who are searching for ways to be actively engaged in changing the world. That then brings them within a realm of conversation where they can develop as leaders if they want to. It also happens in Africa on the ground, where we've developed leaders through imaginal malaria. And we've discovered that when congregations get excited about something like imaginal malaria, something that is outside themselves, they quit focusing on this god-awful narrative of decline that we are in and have been in for the last 30 years, and start focusing on what they can do in the world. And that excites them, and they find themselves becoming energized and renewed without having a blueprint for being energized and renewed, because they didn't follow the method, you know, in the correct way. And so What? They didn't get the metrics right. They didn't fill out the dashboard quite the right way, you know? So Skylar, I think trying to take advantage of some of those kinds of, as you all have done in your annual conference, are a way to begin to get us more externally focused than internally focused. And listening to those voices and reporting stories about those voices that make us feel like we've got to do something is a way to do that as well. I think there's more power in this room to tell those stories, perhaps, than we own up to, and that we need to own up to the power of our own ability to communicate and to call the church to be engaged in ministry. And we do that without being manipulative. We do that in a genuine concern for the whole world and for the people that we know need to be engaged with the church in some way. Does that answer, Skylar?
Hey, I would just that just what you just said and what Skylar just said. That's why I raised my hand. I was like, yeah, excited. And that is, you know, you talked about realizing our power as communicators. And are there three ways you could suggest to us right now that we can go home and own that power as communicators? For example, I spend all my time editing everyone else's content, for example. And we had a speaker this morning who asked us, a pastor actually, who said, please write op-eds and hold us accountable to tell the truth. I mean, it was great to hear that. How do we go home and start to transform the way we view ourselves?
I think we can do it carefully by helping to frame some of the conversations that are going on in the church around revitalization and around vital congregations. I think we can do it through blog posts. I think we can do it through the editorial selection of the content that we provide to audiences. And I think we can do it by developing ways to enable people to communicate, whether that is through virtual communities like Twitter and Facebook and others. There's this group that is on Facebook that I subscribe to. It's United Methodist Clergy. I've forgotten exactly the name, but it just pops up automatically. And there's an ongoing conversation about concerns that these clergy have about the pastoral ministry, where we can enable that kind of conversation. And one of the things that I think we do is not only, I think there's a legitimate role for us to be instructional. And I say that out of the long history of the church, that there is this tradition of the apologetic. You know what? And the apologetic means the church engaging in conversation with the world. It does not mean apologizing for the faith. It means a conversation with the world in which you explain faith to people who don't understand faith. So I think creating ways for people to engage in conversation through Twitter groups, through Facebook groups, and in other ways is a really important role for us as communicators. It also is a way for us to allow voices to be heard. Sometimes we find at UMCOM the same voices can get really monotonous, and sometimes they can be really negative, and so we have to moderate those. But that isn't a reason enough to not have those conversations. So you open up the website to those sorts of conversations. You help frame through blog posts and through editorials and through other ways considered, sophisticated analysis that you all can do because you're writing about the church and you may know more about the church in its breadth than anybody else in the church. If you don't, you're not doing your job. Because we're communicators. We have to understand the whole church, and we have to see the whole church in the whole world. It's not just about our district or our annual conference or local congregation. It's about the United Methodist Church globally. And we need to understand and be writing about that and framing that. And so those are three things. Did that answer your question? Okay.
Skylar, share what we talked about, content curation. Share that thought.
Yeah. I know we all have so many things that come at us at all times from so many different sources. And what do you think about there's also this, I'm struggling to find the word here. There's this myth, I think, around our leaders, our denominational leaders, that our jobs are easy and that it's as simple as sending a tweet and it's as simple as catching this or as simple as catching that. But how do you get to compel them to know what we do and how we do it and the challenge that it is to produce content, to edit content, and to also help them sustain their messages?
Because you used the word editing, and earlier he said content curator, which I thought was a great phrase. And maybe just your reaction to that in terms of how we shape the conversation.
I think we have to have some pretty straightforward conversations with them. I think we have to help them understand, and I've had these unpleasant conversations. For me, they're unpleasant, in which I've said to someone who wanted me to do something, you know what? There is no audience anymore. Professor Jay Rosen at the New York University School of Journalism coined the phrase, the people formerly known as the audience. Now, why did he say that? Because the audience is also the user group, they're also the producer, and there is no audience. So, friends, this is a generic statement. There is no group anxiously awaiting with bated breath to hear what you've got to say. And it starts up here, and it goes down this chain, and it gets spread out by the district superintendent, and it goes to the local pastor, and they wait for the word at the bottom as if it were refreshing water on a hot, dry day. That world is gone. We might act like that world still exists, and we might wish that that world still exists, but that world is gone. I've given a speech at United Methodist Publishing House and gone back to my office, and folks said to me, hey, that was pretty neat what you said, or why did you say that? And I say, how the heck did you know what I just said? Well, because there were five people tweeting what you said. Well, that's the world that we live in. And so we need to help them understand that we can help them because they are exposed. If they don't know this, they are exposed. And we're there, to, in a way, to protect them and to guide them. And I would have that as a very straightforward conversation. And I would also say that we want to do this because it's in your best interest for us to do it. It's what we are paid to do. In order to help you communicate more effectively. And I can help you communicate more effectively if I know what you want to say, I know when you want to say it, I know who you want to say it to, I know how we're going to deliver the message. And that takes a lot of time, and I need you to sit down with me and let's talk about that.
I'd add one to that. We also need to say, I need to know what you don't want said,
yes,
so that I can protect you there too. That's been one of my challenges, is to know what's not said. Tim?
Greg, we have about 5 minutes left, so let's take one or two questions.
That's where I was at. If we got a couple of quick questions from out here, we can get those in an answer. And because we do want to stay on time, have some time for the book signing as well as on to the rest of the afternoon. Is there somebody who's itching to ask a question? That wasn't a very itching stretch, but...
Larry, in your book, you talk about how there is no message.
Yeah.
And in this world, we heard about it from Mike earlier, that there's so many things clamoring for our attention that it's really hard for the United Methodist Church especially to raise a signal and have something distinctive to say among all of the things that are already out there. What are some tips for those who are, whether they're at the local church level or at the denominational level, in terms of how to raise that signal and and be heard in the midst of all of this noise in our society with social media and blogging and everything else that's going on.
I think one of the things that the biggest tip that I have is encourage your bishop, if he or she is still talking about membership loss and decline, to just stop. That isn't the message that we want to send. And that's the message that we've been sending for the last 30 years. So we want to stop that. The other is we need to find those positive stories that are happening. We've talked about imaginal malaria, but there are others. There is the ministry with the poor. There's wonderful examples of the church engaged in mission and doing constructive things through ministry with the poor. And we need to be pointing to those. We need to be tweeting about those. We need to be linking those. And we need to learn how to do that strategically so that we are hitting people repetitively with them. We know that folks go to Facebook at different times of the day and use it in different ways. And so to post something once on Facebook is not sufficient because you're very likely to lose that exposure to all of the others who are not there at that time. So using social media and linking strategically, and using Hootsuite as an example that retweets and do that on a schedule, and finding out how people are using social media, when they are on the website, what they're looking for, and how they enter and leave the website, all of which is pretty much available through Google Analytics. And I think the other thing is to focus on those ways that people can get engaged. That we tell the stories of how they can get involved with a church that is doing a food pantry or any other kind of an experience that is relevant to a group of people, and just keep strategically making the invitation for that.
We have another question? I think they're all anxious to leave time for you to maybe sign a book for them, Larry. And the process here, again, is that there's some coupons on the table, and some UMCOM staff will help see you get those. There's a auditing process they need to do, so that's what's with the coupon and all. And if you don't have a coupon, Kathy's going to take care of you because we want you to have it. And also your cards for about webinar suggestions, times, those come back to Kathy, right? And any other announcements before we do a Fairfax on third floor is where we have the event at 4:30. Is that right? Okay. So, Larry, before we all break, there's my book and there's a pen. And thank you all for coming to being part of Shop Talk for this afternoon. And you're welcome to come as polite Christians to step forward here where we have the books.
Since Mike was so pointed in the fact that we shouldn't be giving away our content, if you all feel so compelled that you want to pay for the book, you might make a donation to Imaginal Malaria instead.